Notes from Underground. The Italian Renaissance Pacific Electric subway terminal building on Hill Street in Los Angeles was designed by Schultze and Weaver, the firm responsible for the same city's Biltmore Hotel and New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The 1925 building is the terminus of a rail tunnel connected to alleviate traffic on downtown streets. Lines from Hollywood and Glendale, as well as several other points, converged here in the basement of the building. Angelino's unaware that there was a red car subway before there was a red line subway may recognize the building as part of the grand panorama sketched by the aspiring architect played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt in the movie 500 Days of Summer. It is wedged behind an ungainly parking garage, but sports a double row of Trump dial windows to complete its profile. Lovely to behold, the subway terminal was no joke as a train station. At its peak, more than 65,000 people passed through the station each day. The current ridership of the Metro Rail system is around 324,000 on weekdays. Passengers would enter through vaulted, coffered archways, then glide past Corinthian columns, cigarette stands, and concessions, down sloping ramps that would not have looked out of place in Grand Central Terminal, to a mezzanine, then down ramps again, to one of five terminal tracks. Trains moved through a double-track tunnel to a portal at 2nd Street and Glendale Boulevard, where there is a small yard for storing cars. The Temple Street Viaduct offers a glimpse of the yard, although there's not much to see, and the tunnel has been sealed at both ends, save for an eerie remnant adjacent to the terminal itself, which was kept open to serve as a fallout shelter during the Cold War. The terminal was closed in 1955, after the building's owners sued Pacific Electric, which was actually a tenant, for its underperforming income stream. The office building itself has fared better, occupied by the Social Security Administration and many smaller offices for a period. It underwent a sensitive restoration by Brenda Levin in 1979, and another renovation by Page and Turnbull in 2005, after the passage of the City of Los Angeles's 1999 Adaptive Reuse Ordinance. Its owners, Forest City, received a Federal Historic Preservation Credit, which matches 20% of the cost of restoration, only if the cost of that restoration exceeds the value of the building, according to John Lezak, a principal at Page and Turnbull. The developer has turned the upper floors into 277 units of housing and rebranded the building as Metro 417, at a cost of about $350 per square foot, according to Evan Jenny, a manager with Metro 417. The vast, cavernous space on the ground floor remains unoccupied. Plaster hangs from above, exposing concrete ribs. Skylights are patched to prevent leaks. Columns are shorn of decoration below their pilasters. Concrete spalls and dribbles rusty water stains. As one descends into the gloaming, the honeysuckle smell of lukewarm dust turns into the dark stench of must and mold. It is very easy to imagine a ghost train coasting past the old interlocking tower, or a really awesome rave, with the DJ occupying the tower. Remnants of glory are everywhere, from hand-stenciled thumbs pointing the way to track 5, to tiled floors and elegant patterned ceilings. Currently, the ground and basement terminal spaces are used for storage and refuse. Here one sees a collection of heavy wooden doors, there an agglomeration of tightly packed toilets, like a Duchamp by way of Damien Hirst. There's even a Liechtenstein print. Jenny refers to the track level as the Matrix Room. The vast spaces of ground floor, basement, and track level have all the trappings of a post-apocalyptic movie. As much as one might want to see a thumping nightclub or site-specific art installation, the current hope is that Ralph's or Trader Joe's might move in. Forest City is trying to fill these gigantic spaces, but they are problematic because they don't meet current fire code for exiting, and the requirements for historic preservation might prove daunting for a grocery store with a standardized floor layout, Lezak says. The popular story of the Pacific Electric's demise is that an automotive cabal conspired to bring it down by purchasing its lines, then sneakily replaced the rail cars with buses, rolling on Firestone tires and GM motors. This perception was revived in vivid color with the release in 1987 of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which has to be the funniest and perhaps the only feature film about urban planning and public transit. the buyout did happen, but there was no single Judge Doom in the story. The real story is much more complex. Others have chronicled it in immense detail, so I'll summarize. The PE, which had struggled to stay in the black throughout the 1930s, entered a campaign of deferred maintenance during the Depression and World War II, and continued to act like the unanswerable private monopoly it was, even as ridership slackened in the 1950s, after a short boost during the war. The company got into a dispute over street maintenance responsibilities with the Los Angeles Department of Streets, which made replacing the tracks with buses seem very reasonable. There was an unfortunate decision not to stage a public takeover of the remaining street and interurban railways, and then, yes, our love affair with the automobile and the building of the freeways sealed the deal. The combination of short-sighted business and government leaders, and a complacent population that had soured on the rattling cars that clogged the streets, turned our forebears into a collective Judge Doom. The bitter spoils we reap for not having had the foresight to upgrade and maintain the system, our eye-gouging traffic congestion, and the task of relaying tracks at a cost of millions per mile, largely along the same alignments ripped up 60 years ago to give us the Red Line and the newly opened Expo Line. But rather than shake our fists at the indignity, let us consider the progress we have made since the early 1990s, when there were 0 miles of electric rail transit in Los Angeles. Yes, the new Expo Line is over budget, behind schedule, and deposits riders in the low-rise, light industrial neighborhood of La Cienega and Jefferson, rather than the vibrant downtown Culver City, as promised. Design critics have quibbled that its uniform, undulating, perforated canopies are under-inspired, and even though NIMBYs in both low- and high-income neighborhoods seem unable to reconcile with the concept of a train running at grade and have protested at every opportunity. But despite all this, it does appear that, in our lifetimes, we will once again be able to ride an electric train all the way from downtown to the ocean. Looking back at the glories of the Pacific Electric Building, also converted to loft apartments and containing the French Dip Emporium Kohl's and the subway terminal, can make our current transit environment look like it was designed in a period of lowered expectations. In an ideal world, the PE would never have been abandoned. But for all the attention lavished on its signature buildings, most people experience the PE as a bumpy, slow, non-air-conditioned ride that required walking to the middle of a street to stand on a tiny platform or at a dusty whistle stop. For all its flaws, the elusive direct airport connection being a chief irritant, the current transit system is uniformly designed to a higher standard from the perspective of safety and comfort than the Pacific Electric ever was. It can be a generator of infill development like the PE was a catalyst for new neighborhoods of bungalows in the 1910s. We should be rooting for it to go further, faster, and leave the moaning to the ghosts in the tunnel. Someone seriously needs to take over that space, though. It would make the Edison look like a doghouse.